This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. Go there for all your undergarment needs. They have underwear that has silver in it, so it eliminates the stink. They also have shirts that have that as well. Shopping's a breeze with Mack Weldon. You can buy packages of underwear, boxer briefs, undershirts, socks, all in one fell swoop. If you want to try Mack Weldon at a discount, I got an offer for you. Go to mackweldon.com and use promo code AOM at checkout for 20% off. Again, mackweldon.com. Promo code AOM at checkout for 20% off. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So we typically think of the quality of reverence as connected with religion. But my guest today on the show argues that reverence is a virtue that extends past religious ceremony and is vital for the flourishing of human society. His name is Paul Woodruff. He's professor of humanities at the University of Texas and the author of the book Reverence, Renewing a Forgotten Virtue. And on today's show, Professor Woodruff and I discuss what the ancient Greeks and ancient Chinese can teach us about reverence, why reverence has been forgotten in our modern age, and what you can do in your own life to renew this virtue. Great show with some great insights. After the show is over, be sure to check the show notes at aom.is/reverence. Well, Professor Paul Woodruff, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So you are a professor of philosophy. You've written several books. You focus on Greek philosophy, ancient Greek philosophy. And the book I'd like to talk about today is Reverence, Renewing a Forgotten Virtue. Before we get into reverence, the virtue of reverence and what it looks like, let's talk about virtue in general, because it seems like the framework for reverence is virtue ethics. For those who aren't familiar with virtue ethics, can you give us a summary of what it is and how it differs from other ethical frameworks?
Well, most people think of ethics in terms of rules, like never tell a lie. And rule-based ethics is limited because we all know there are circumstances in which it seems right to tell a lie. For example, when the Gestapo's knocking at the door to ask where the refugees are to take them away. So I think of virtue ethics as adverbial. You know, the brave person is one who lives bravely or courageously as much as he can. And by the way, it's nice to talking about virtue on this website because the etymology of virtue is the Latin word vir for man, manliness, or maturity.
Right.
I think maybe a better word for what we're talking about here. I think of a virtue as not a fixed trait because even the courageous person is sometimes going to fail in courage, but more as a commitment to live in a certain way, to make decisions in a certain way. So the virtue ethicist thinks about adverbs, about how to live and how to make decisions.
And how does one become more virtuous within virtue ethics? I mean, Aristotle wrote a lot about this in the Nicomachean Ethics. So how does one become virtuous?
Well, one becomes virtuous, according to Aristotle, by cultivating the patterns of behavior that you see in virtuous people until those patterns really become yours and you're choosing what to do out of your own character and not simply by imitating others. So it's a dual process, becoming virtuous. The Chinese theory of virtue, there's a fascinating theory of virtue in the Chinese tradition that comes down from Confucius and Mencius. And that starts with the idea that every human being is born with certain sprouts, like rice sprouts, that can grow into virtues if they're properly cultivated. So for Confucian ethics, the goal of ethics is to cultivate one's own capacity for living virtuously. And one does that in society. Long story there.
Right. And so, I mean, the assumption there, I guess, in the Chinese view would be that you can't be virtuous without the virtue, or like you have, I mean, so you already have to have that virtue within you in order for you to be able to cultivate it.
There's got to be something for you to cultivate. And I think if you were born without any sprout of courage or reverence or justice, that it would be very hard for you to develop it. That what perhaps impossible, you'd be a sociopath. In becoming more virtuous, you really need to find what's in you that's already right, and make that better. And the same in interacting with other people, you need to find what they have in them that is moving in the right direction, and try to cultivate that and bring that forward.
Okay, so let's talk about the virtue of reverence. Because I think we've all heard of, you know, think when people think virtues, they think courage, justice, wisdom. But people don't think of reverence. We often associate reverence with religion, but you argue that it's not an exclusively religious virtue. So how do you define reverence so that it's not exclusively in the domain of religion or faith?
Well, let me start with the opposite of reverence. I think the opposite of reverence is what the Greeks call hubris, which is the overweening pride or arrogance of a man who really thinks he has godlike attributes. If you think you can never go wrong, if you think you're invulnerable, if you think that you've been so successful that success will follow you all your life, you're falling into hubris. Reverence is the virtue that protects you from that. Felt recognition of human limitations, a felt recognition of really what it is to be human.
And so, I mean, it's not humility though, right? I mean, it's, even though it's the opposite of hubris, reverence isn't humility per se.
Right, because I think the opposite of humility is pride. And pride is often a good thing. So I some years ago gave a talk on reverence at a meeting of Roman Catholics and nuns. And I was asked this question about humility. And I said that I think people often preach humility to those whom they want to bow down to them. And the nuns all nodded. They were tired of being told to be more humble. And a great soul is compatible with reverence, but it's not compatible with abject humility.
And I believe in your book, you kind of define reverence in terms of feelings, right? It reminded me, I think you have a good definition. It reminded me of the definition of practical wisdom, or I forgot the Greek word for it. But it's like having the right feelings at the right time for the right reason. So reverence seems to be based in feelings, right?
I think all of the virtues are based in feelings. And it's because they're based in feelings, They motivate us. There's not much motivational power in a rule, but if you have in you a strong feeling of courage or a strong feeling of reverence, that is motivating. Feelings make us do things. Shame makes us run away. Courage makes us stand up. Anger makes us want to. Reverence helps us feel awe in the face of something that is a greater power than we are, the transcendent, for example. So certainly reverence can be connected with religion, because the reverent person is feels awe at the thought of God. But I don't think the only transcendent object for which we should feel awe is, there are other transcendence around us. We might feel awe in the presence of nature. We might feel awe in the presence of, at the thought of justice as an ideal, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, those are some good examples of non-religious examples of things you need reverent to. But I think you also talk, you can be reverent towards you know, even political institutions. And that's, I know that might be a hard pill for people to swallow in this day and age when they might be cynical about our political institutions, but reverence is something, that's something you could possibly give reverence to.
Well, our Constitution is an interesting case, and so is our Declaration of Independence. I don't feel reverence for the document in either case, but I do feel reverence for the idea behind it. I just was reading a wonderful book by Danielle Allen called Our Declaration, about the Declaration of Independence. This is an African-American woman finding in the Declaration of Independence a concept of equality that she can share. Well, the authors of that document weren't thinking of it that way at all, but she found in the document a commitment to that idea, which she, for which she does feel reverence, obviously.
And is reverence a public or private virtue, or is it both?
I think it's both. I think it's a public virtue in that reverence is expressed in ceremonies that we bear with other people. I think it helps a great deal in developing any virtue to share it with other people. And in the case of reverence, whenever we are sharing a ceremony, and there are many different kinds of ceremony, they're not all religious. Whenever we're sharing in a ceremony with other people, we are, in fact, bearing a kind of reverence, because when you're conducting a ceremony with the appropriate feelings, are recognizing your own limitations with respect to that ceremony. You're not going to interrupt the ceremony or step into the space that is occupied by the ceremony, and so on. There's a long, interesting story about ceremony and reverence.
Yeah, we'll get to that in here in a bit. So, I mean, why is reverence important? Because I think in this day and age, you know, if reverence is sort of this recognizing your limitations and having, you know, and avoiding hubris, I mean, it seems like our day and age is just like, no, you know, like we are limitless. We can do whatever we want. We can conquer anything if we put our mind to it and our will to it. So why would reverence be an important counter to that that feeling that we have to like try to be limitless in our lives?
Well, I think it's important because without reverence, we are vulnerable to fall into hubris. Hubris leads to overreaching, and overreaching to catastrophe. The Greeks understood this very well. That's the kernel of tragic wisdom. And we've seen examples of this. I think the United States, after what it believed to be a triumphant success, Cold War, went on a rampage of hubristic decisions. We deregulated important elements of the economy, which produced the crash of 08. We invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. There, of course, are controversies about these, but I think it's fairly clear now that the idea that we could, by force of arms, create a friendly democracy in Iraq was full of hubris. It was a disastrous decision. And a good example of a failure of reverence in high places.
Oh, yeah. Well, so, yeah, that was interesting, the point you made, that hubris is most, we're most susceptible to hubris in the point of victory. I think Napoleon even talked about that. They said the most dangerous moment in battle is the moment of victory, because that's when people, that's when soldiers can get a little crazy and just go on a rampage, or they'll get overconfident and let their guard down a bit.
Well, and think of Napoleon believing that he could conquer and Hitler having the same view, thinking that he could send an army into Russia and bring it to its knees. Both decisions led to catastrophes for the invading armies.
So I mean, we just talked about reverence on a meta level, a very public level. I mean, but let's go down to the individual. How can reverence make us, you know, better parents or better citizens or better, you know, teachers, for example?
Well, I think a very important virtue for parents and teachers and for anybody who has authority over others. It's valuable to be able to remember at each point that you're not a god, that you can be wrong, that you need to listen to other people, who don't listen, our parents who may very well find themselves seriously at odds with their children. And I see examples of this every year in among my own students. If they have parents who are not listening to them, there can be very serious breaks. It can lead to catastrophes for the family and the students. A student who can't tell his parents that he doesn't want to go to medical school, might have no other recourse than to fail all his courses. And I've seen that happen. That's a self-destructive result. A student who cannot tell his parents that he's gay may take his life. And I've seen that sad result too. And that's because of a lack of reverence on the part of this. It's very sad to watch that. Teachers also, I think, need to be able to listen and remember that they're not divine.
Yeah, and that can be hard whenever you have a class full of people in there who are forced to listen to you.
Right.
They're there, right, and get to your head. So you mentioned, we've mentioned the ancient Greeks and the ancient Chinese and about their insights about reverence. Why did they think and write so much about the virtue of reverence? I mean, why was it important to them?
Reverence was important in the Confucian tradition, I think, for two reasons. One is that ceremony was very much built into this culture from the beginning. And I think a large part of Confucius' motivation in trying to introduce ethical reforms in the early period was that he felt that ceremonies were being conducted merely by rote, without any sense of their meaning, without any feeling for what they meant. So he said, for example, about filial piety, so the son gives food to his elderly parents any better than the owner who gives food to his dog. The difference would be in the feeling of reverence that accompanied the act of piety, and so on. So it was very important for them in connection with ceremony. I think it was also important to the Chinese because Chinese culture was traditionally very hierarchical. And I think the more hierarchical the culture, the more important it is that people high up in the hierarchy recognize and are frequently reminded that they're not gods. And part of the purpose of ceremony in Chinese political life, I think, was to remind the emperor and other high up people that there was something to which they were subordinate. So the emperor was called the son of heaven. One way of reminding him he's not God.
And in the ancient Greeks, I mean, why was reverence so important to them?
Why was reverence so important for the Greeks?
Yes.
I think it was important for the Greeks for different reasons. The Greek life was never so ceremonial, and it wasn't so hierarchical. The Greeks, I think, were resistant to hierarchy right from Homeric times. We see the soldiers trying to rebel against the generals in the beginning of Homer's Iliad. But as the Greeks developed democratic institutions, it became very important for them to recognize the difference between a leader and a tyrant. And the difference is reverence. That shows up a lot in Greek literature. Tyrant is full of hubris. Inflamed by hubris, he overreaches and stumbles, and there's a disaster for him and sometimes for his people as well. Whereas the leader, out of reverence, recognizes his humanity, recognizes the humanity of others, and is a more equal part of a community. So for Greeks, I think it was part of the democratic thinking.
That's interesting. So there's like two different political systems, one very hierarchical, one more democratic, but both relied on reverence to keep them going.
That's how I see it.
Yeah. And yeah, in the ancient Greeks, you're right. They did write a lot about reverence. I mean, I think the tragedies, it's all about reverence when you get down to it.
I think so.
Right. I mean, Oedipus Rex, you know, that's when he became a tyrant, when he just killed that guy on the road that ended up being his dad, didn't show reverence there. And then I guess Antigonia, is that the one where the guy couldn't bury, the lady couldn't bury her brother?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
All acts of hubris. It's interesting. So let's talk about this. You say reverence is a forgotten virtue. Why is that? Why has reverence become a forgotten virtue in our day and age?
Well, I think there are two reasons why, especially in American culture, reverence is forgotten. One of them is that we have forgotten the importance of ceremony, and that has something to do with the revolution in Christianity that the Reformation represents. Protestants increasingly have rejected ceremony, which they associated with the Catholics that they were rejecting. Well, I think that's part of it, is the intensely Protestant nature of our culture. And I say that as somebody who grew up in a Protestant tradition. But I think it's also due to our cultural commitment to rejecting hierarchy. I think there's a sad faith in that, because there's hierarchy everywhere you look in our society. We're not free of hierarchy, and yet we like to think that we are. And so we forget that very often we are in positions of great authority that require reverence.
You know, I think it's interesting that we don't have much of a hierarchy in our culture today, but you know, even the Greeks, they didn't have really hierarchy, but yet they were able to still cultivate reverence. So why were they able to do it, but we're not able to?
I think that the ancient Greeks had a culture that was infused with the tragic wisdom that arrogance leads to overreaching, which leads to a fall. And we just don't seem to have that in our culture. And I think that perhaps we don't have it in the culture because our history has been one of successful overreaching from one side of the country to the other. America has been very successful in reaching what were supposed to be its boundaries. The War of Independence was partly about pushing back the boundaries that the British had set for westward expansion. We just don't like limits. We don't like human limits at all. We I think, are reluctant in our culture to accept human limitations. I think we've reached a point which we're going to be in more and more serious trouble if we don't.
If we don't recognize our limitations. We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. All right, every man should have at least one suit in their wardrobe. You're going to wear it to job interviews, funerals, weddings, or even a nice night on the town. And you can go to the department store and buy something off the rack. And even if you get it tailored to fit you, it's still not going to fit you as well if you got it made to measure. Indochino allows you to get a made-to-measure suit, customized how you want it, at the price you'd pay at the department stores for an off-the-rack suit. Indochino is one of the largest made-to-measure menswear brands. They're making it easy for men to getting a great-fitting, high-quality suits and shirts at an incredible price. This is how it works. I've done this before. I have a navy blue suit from Indochino. You visit Indochino.com or drop by one of their 9 North American showrooms. Pick from hundreds of fabrics and patterns. Choose your customizations from lapels to pleats to jacket linings and more. You submit your body measurements. They have this easy followed online guide to help measure yourself. Then you kick back, relax, and get ready to step into the best, most stylish suit you've ever worn in just 4 weeks. If you want to try Indochino at a discount, I got an offer for you. This week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $389 at Indochino.com when entering manliness at checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for made-to-measure premium suit. Plus, shipping is free and your satisfaction is guaranteed or your money back. Again, that's Indochino.com, promo code manliness for any premium suit for just $389 and free shipping. You'll never have to worry about a badly fitting suit or expensive trips to the tailor again. Get ready to look like $1 million. Also by 5-4 Club. So if you're like me, you hate shopping for clothes because it takes a lot of time and also be kind of confusing trying to figure out what goes with what. 5-4 Club solves this problem. You sign up and your clothes shopping is put on autopilot. You pay $60 a month, and once a month, they're going to send you a box of clothes you can't get anywhere else. That's worth $120. Here's how it works. You sign up at 5-4 Club, easy sign-up process. You tell them your style profile, classic, casual, forward, or mix. I'm a classic guy, so I get things like Henleys, button-down shirts, nice pairs of jeans. And what's nice about 5-4 Club is that they're going to build on your wardrobe as they send you these clothes. So the stuff you get, you know, 2 months later is going to go with the stuff you got 2 months before. And as the season changes, the clothes change. So now I'm getting a lot of long sleeve Henleys, getting some jackets in my 5-4 Club boxes. If you want to try 5-4 Club at a discount, I got an offer for you. Go to 5-4club.com and use promo code manliness at checkout at sign up and get 50% off for the first month of 5-4 Club packages. Again, that's 5-4club.com, promo code manliness for 50% off your first month of 5-4 Club packages. Offer expires at the end of October, so hurry. And now back to the show.
Well, okay, let's go back to this idea of ceremony and the reverent life. I mean, why is ritual and ceremony an important part of reverence?
I think we develop reverence by speaking the language of reverence, which is the language of ritual and ceremony. When you meet and shake hands, we don't think of that as anything terribly special, but it is actually, it seems to me, expressing a measure of reverence. Here we are in together, we're both human, we greet each other, we shake hands. When a student puts up her hand in the classroom, before speaking so as not to interrupt another, that's an act of reverence, a very small and subtle one, but a very important one, because it is a little ceremony that greases, oils the gears of human interaction.
And I mean, as you said, Confucius was worried about the possibility of having ceremony without reverence. Sort of just rote thing. So, I mean, how do you ensure that these rituals or ceremonies that pop up in our life, whether big or small, maintain a measure of reverence within them?
That's hard. And I think it's also really important. I think to maintain meaningful ritual and ceremony, we have to be prepared to change as society itself changes. What it means to be a friend in terms of ritual and ceremony is being changed by the internet. And I, as an older person, don't know this very well, but there are, of course, rituals that are involved in the social media that are being did without much forethought, but I think they're probably very important to the ongoing relationships that develop on these new media. We have to be prepared for all kinds of change. If you just stick with the same ceremonies and let them become dry and brittle and stiff, then of course the feeling is going to fall away from them, and we'll go look for something else. A lot of traditional forms of Christian worship are falling away among Protestants especially, and we have new styles of worship, new styles of church, and that's what we need, is a willingness to evolve new ceremonies, or to find ways of infusing old ceremonies with new meaning.
So, I mean, I guess it is possible. So reverence to tradition, you can have it, but you don't want it to be rigid, because that's what will lead to that sort of calcified, empty ritual.
Calcified is a good word, yeah.
And so, I mean, I guess you could use your reverence towards tradition to maybe create something new, revitalize, using that reverence towards tradition to revitalize and make something new.
Exactly. Well put.
I think it reminds me, we had Ted Linden on the pod. He's a classicist. He wrote The Ghost of War. And he talked about the ancient Greeks' reverence towards Homer and the Iliad and the epic poems. And that's where they sort of use that reverence to create new ways of fighting. So the phalanx was inspired by that, but it was new. It was radically different from what how they fought in the Iliad, but they had this reverence towards it that allowed them to create this new form of battle, more a ritualized form of battle.
Yes, for the Greeks especially, war did involve ritual. They went into battle singing the paean. They went into battle in line, each man carrying a fairly small shield, which protected both himself and the arm of the man to his left. This is a concept that I think is still important in our own military. Part of the goal of military training is to teach people through military ceremony how to be interdependent and how to function together in a unit.
And have a reverent attitude towards war.
Yes.
Which is kind of interesting. People wouldn't think you'd need reverence in war, but the Greeks are very conscious about being reverent even in war.
Well, yes, and they're conscious of how easy it is in war to overreach. The Iliad is wonderful about it. You know, Patroclus goes off into battle wearing Achilles' armor, which is already a little act of hubris, and is so successful, partly because people think he is Achilles and run away from him, so successful that he goes too far. And because he goes too far, he's killed. And then the man who kills him, Hector, is so puffed up with his own success at killing Patroclus and winning various other aspects of the battle that he stays out on the battlefield after his wise younger brother advises him to go in. And that leads to disaster. So they were well aware that you need to keep yourself under control in battle and realize that you are mortal, that you can be hurt, and that the people around you can be hurt.
So you mentioned shame earlier, and you talk about shame a lot throughout the book. And shame, I feel like today in our culture, has a stigma to it. Like, shame is bad. You don't want to feel shameful. Shame is toxic, is the thing you say. But you argue that shame, it plays a vital role in a reverent life. Why is that?
Well, shame, I think of as alien to our culture. And along with that, we pretend that honor is not very important either. Honor and shame are a pair of values, good and bad. In my experience as a manager and leader in the academic sphere, I was a chairman and a dean and a director. I've had lots of administrative jobs. In my experience, people are more concerned about honor and shame in the workplace than they are about their salaries. Salaries matter partly because of the lower salary is thought of shameful, and the higher salary is thought of as an honor. I think shame is one of the most powerful motivators in human life. Shame gets you moving. The coach will get the player moving by shaming the player. In warfare, people go forward into danger because they're ashamed in the face of their friends to run away. Shame is enormously important, but shame, of course, can lead us to do terrible things. So I think it's important to recognize that the reverent person feels shame at the right time and in the right way and for the right reasons. One reason Hector dies in the Iliad is that he's ashamed to go in and face the brother who advised him to stay out. And shame leads to death, which leads to the destruction of Troy. So shame can be terribly harmful. So we're right to be nervous about it. But so can other emotions. Anger can be harmful. Anger makes you want to hit people. And anger can be very harmful. On the other hand, we need to have a capacity for anger. Because when things are wrong, when wrong things are done to us or people around us, if we don't feel anger, I think we're seriously morally deficient. But like shame, anger felt in the right way, in the right amount, and at the right people, and so on. So the virtuous person is the person who's committed to directing these emotions in the best way.
So I think this raises an interesting point. So shame and honor, they're social feelings, right? They're feelings you get because other people are watching you. And so, I mean, that suggests that reverence, it's hard to live a reverent life by yourself as a hermit. I mean, do you need to be embedded in a community to actually, live the full expression of reverence?
I believe that, yes. I think for all of the virtues, you need to be embedded in a community. We are social animals. We need each other to be human is to speak a language. You can't speak a language yourself. You need to have other people in order to learn a language, let alone actually speak it. So I think being part of a community is essential to being a human being. The Greeks, again, who have such an influence on my thought, the Greeks felt that a human being was a social animal and therefore couldn't really live a human life as a recluse entirely. A god would have the power to live alone, and they thought that wild beasts might be able to live alone. I think they were wrong about the beasts. But the thought that you could live a fully human life completely on your own without being part of a community is the hubris of thinking that you have divine powers. We're not divine. We need each other.
And do those individuals you're embedded with, like, in order to be reverent, do they also need to be reverent? I mean, what if you live in a community that just full of irreverence? Would it be possible to cultivate that virtue within yourself, surrounded by other individuals who don't have reverence?
I think there's a lot of luck in living a virtuous life. If you're born into a slaveholding society and you're taught to treat other human beings with violence and contempt, it will be hard for you to be a good person. If you're born into a society that has only contempt for ceremony and politeness, it will be hard for you to cultivate reverence, perhaps impossible. I think if you're born into a society that is deeply vicious in one way or another, you're morally unlucky. I sometimes use the example of courage. Suppose I want to be courageous, and I've been put in a military unit that is commanded by a coward, in which everyone is a coward. I want to practice acts of courage to become more courageous, but I simply cannot practice courage by myself. If I run up alone against the machine gun nest, I do something really stupid and I'll be killed, and that's not courage. Courage is not stupid. You need to develop a virtue. You need to be able to practice it. And to practice it, you need to be with other people who allow you to practice it, who give you a context in which you can practice it. But we need virtuous communities.
So you need to be thoughtful about the people you associate with if you want to cultivate this virtue.
That's true. I was pleased. One of my daughters actually chose her high school with this in mind. She thought if she went to high school A, she would have to be part of a community that would be good for her. So she went to high school B instead, recognizing, I think, intuitively the importance of the kind of community you're in for the kind of person you grew up.
That make you feel proud as a dad and as a philosophy professor?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I bet. So we've been talking about sort of around the edge of things you can do to cultivate reverence in your life, take part in ceremonies, recognize your limitations. But I mean, your book's about renewing reverence. I mean, I know it's hard to boil this down into five talking points, but any things or actions that people can do to cultivate a more reverent life within themselves?
Well, first of all, I think we should pay attention. There are awe-inspiring experiences that we can so easily have the beauty of there's beauty in things that we normally think of as being ugly. You walk across a road and there's a little oil spill and there's a rainbow in a puddle. That could be awe-inspiring. We can practice awe by paying attention to all the beauties around us, by noticing the beauty in the most common sparrow that flies across in front of us. We can pay attention to the sunrise and the sunset. Everyone gets one each of those a day, and they're awe-inspiring. But paying attention is the first thing. I think the second talking point I would have about renewing reverence is finding occasions to speak which of the languages of reverence, finding ceremonial occasions of various kinds. I think music is one of the languages of reverence. Poetry can be of reverence. You don't have to go to a church or a synagogue or a mosque or a temple to have the kind of experience that will cultivate reverence for you, with you. And then perhaps the third thing is to keep asking yourself what you're doing. Pay attention to your own actions and what they mean. It would be very dangerous to suppose, well, I've been a reverent person all my life, and I am safely ensconced in my virtue. I don't have to worry about this anymore. That's very dangerous. That's hubris, in fact. So you need to be aware of yourself and of what you're doing on each occasion, and never feel that you've got it made, morally speaking. Think of reverence as a continuing commitment and not something you achieve. And then with other people, I talk about asking the right question. The most irreverent seeming person has somewhere in him or her a little sprout, a little green growing sprout of reverence that you could identify if you the right question.
So ask the right questions. That's great. Well, Professor Woodruff, this has been a great conversation. Is there anywhere people can go to learn more about your work?
Well, I don't have a website, but my books are all on Amazon, and they're all in print. And so you can find, there's a little page in Amazon with my things on it. The most recent book is a second edition of the book on reverence, which has a new chapter on renewing reverence and also a chapter on sacred, respecting what is sacred in other people's traditions, which I think is very important. And also a chapter on compassion, which I believe is a very important part of reverence. And then the most recent book before that revision is called The Ajax Dilemma, which is really about reverent leadership.
Well, very good. Well, we'll be sure to link to that on our website when we publish the podcast so people can find those. Professor Woodruff, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure. My guest today is Paul Woodruff. He's a professor of humanities at the University of Texas. He's also the author of the book Reverence, Renewing a Forgotten Virtue, and it's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. Our show is edited by Creative Audio Lab here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you have any audio editing needs or audio production needs, check them out at creativeaudiolab.com. If you enjoy the show, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It really helps us out. As always, thank you for your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.